This is the 2017 Pacific Northwest Daughters of Sarah Weekend. Brother Roger Lewis is leading our studies on the topic Hannah, Handmaid of the Highest. This is class 3 entitled Hannah and Her Loan. The introductory reading was 1 Samuel chapter 1 verses 19 to 28.
Well, thank you again, Brother Chairman. And now, the last part of the 1 Samuel, chapter 1. How convenient that we have two full study days and two full chapters to consider, as it's turned out to be. So, in the 1 Samuel, chapter 1, then, we come now to that section that we've read together by means of our brother, as the record begins in verse 19. They rose up in the morning early and worshipped and came to their house to Ramah. So, do you notice, again, the spirit of this family? They're going to make their way home. So they decide on an early start, which lots of families do when they're going to make the journey home. Let's get up early and get this journey underway. And yet the record says that the first thing they did, they made a point of attending the sanctuary for a final act of worship before returning home. Now, this is, remember, in an age of overwhelming wickedness. And yet this family said, let's go back to worship at the sanctuary first, before we leave. You see, there's an outstanding spirit of dedication in this family. And clearly, Elkanah will be part of that spirit. It may have been Hannah's suggestion, who knows, but they all went back to the sanctuary first, before the journey home begins. And you can just imagine that when this walking back to the sanctuary for this last act of worship before they left, on this occasion, Hannah must have been a joyful participant. There was, I think, something in her manner that Elkanah was thinking, what's happened here? Because she's so calm and so serene, and there's such a tranquil spirit about her as they're back at the sanctuary, that Elkanah's already thinking, I need to have a chat to her when we get home, because I don't know what's happened, but Hannah is looking to be at peace. But I must needs find out why. I'm thankful, but it would be nice to know why. And so he no doubt decided that at some stage some private conversation between he and his wife would be needed. And by the way, it certainly was, wasn't it? Because, you see, one of the questions, I suppose, about the vow of the 1 Samuel chapter 1 is, should Hannah have made such a vow without Elkanah's knowledge? And the answer, I think, partly lies in the fact that a divine counsel, you remember, permitted any man or woman to offer a peace offering, Leviticus chapter 3. Any male or female may do that. It allowed any man or woman to commit to a Nazarite pledge, Numbers chapter 6, whether any man or woman do make a vow to separate themselves unto Yahweh. It authorized any man or woman to bind their soul with a vow. So men and women are equal in their capacity to love the truth and to worship God in the spirit of holiness, to draw near before him in fervent prayer, to ascend into the holiest, to find fellowship with the Creator who is the Lord of hosts. There's no constraint upon a sister to exercise her deepest spiritual faculties in the truth. But there are mutual responsibilities within a marriage bond. And Hannah knew that she must talk with Elkanah eventually to share her vow and to ask for his endorsement. Now just come and have a look at this. It's back in Numbers 30, isn't it? The Law of Vows. Well, it's one of the two chapters on the Law of Vows. Numbers chapter 30 says this, and it is very relevant to our story. So it says in Numbers 30, verses 1 to 3, Moses spake unto the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which Yahweh hath commanded. If a man vow a vow unto Yahweh, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. So a vow absolutely committed a person. The spirit of making a vow was very serious indeed. Verse 3 says, if a woman also vow a vow unto Yahweh and bind herself by a bond, well, now the law concerning women's vows comes into play. In the first case, it talks about an unmarried woman. But when we come down to verse 10, we come to the section concerning husbands. And notice now what the record says. Even for unmarried women, by the way, it says this, verse 7, her husband heard it and held his peace at her in the day that he heard it, then her vows shall stand, verse 7. Or again, verse 8, if her husband disallowed her on the day that he heard it, then he shall make the vow of none effect. Again, verse 12, if her husband has utterly made them void on the day he heard them. Again, verse 14, but if her husband altogether hold his peace at her from day to day, then he establisheth all her vows or all her bonds which are upon her. He confirmeth them because he held his peace at her when? In the day that he heard them. Now, notice it doesn't say in the day she uttered them. It's in the day he heard them. Those 2 days may not be the same moment. But at some point he must hear them in order to make the decision. So it's only when he hears that responsibility is going to be brought into play as to whether the husband would allow or disallow. And the very words of verse 13, when it says, every vow and every binding oath to afflict the soul, her husband may establish or her husband may make void. And the very words of that verse are really echoed, aren't they, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, when she was in bitterness of soul and vowed a vow. And Numbers 30 says, if a woman makes a binding oath to afflict her soul, a binding oath, a vow, then the husband must be brought into play as to whether this might be permitted or no. Now, you notice in Numbers 30 this. When it says in verse 11 and 12 that the vow will stand, that word stand in verse 11 and in verse 12 is the same word as establish in verse 13 and verse 14. Her husband may establish it. And that's the same word as confirmeth in verse 14. He confirmeth them. It's all the same word in the Hebrew. So whether her vow would be established might now, well, in fact, would now be subject to the decision of her husband. Now, why that's interesting, brothers and sisters, is because there's no brothers present. I said that because of tradition, didn't I? Why that's interesting, sisters, in terms of coming back to the 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 19, I think, is that Hannah arrives in a state of emotional stress, doesn't she? She goes and makes her prayer. She makes vow to God. Eli says, may the God of Israel grant thy petition, and now they're going home. And you could imagine that if she had the wrong attitude, you know what she would have said? Oh, I've got to get home, and I've got to explain all this to Elkanah, and I've got to go through the whole of the Numbers 30 thing, and he might disagree, and now she's back to being stressed to get all the way home to Ramah. It could be, couldn't it? And yet I don't think we get any sense of that in the record. The record seems to imply that they got up and they worshipped and they went back home, and somehow that same Hannah that was at peace at the sanctuary is the same Hannah that walks all the way home at peace. And I think there was a reason why she was at peace, which is, by the way, what Eli had said, that go in peace, he said. Well, she did. And I think the reason was this. You see, she understood the meaning of all this. She knew that if God could hear her and if God could grant to her a son, then couldn't God work a work with her husband? Couldn't God work a work to convince him of the spirit and importance of the vow? The same God that could give her a son? Couldn't that same God work with her husband? And And of course, the answer is, of course he could. And you see, Hannah realizes this now. What she's done is she's given it to God. She says, God, I place this matter in your hands. She knew that he could do both those things. She didn't need to worry about this. And that's one of the amazing benefits of what happens when, in the despair of our most anguished prayers, we finally surrender to God and we learn to cast all our cares upon him. And when finally we've cast all our cares upon him, I mean all our cares, when we finally surrender the matter to the Father, we have this strange sense of peace. That it's in God's hands now. You see, she knew that if her purpose in seeking a man-child was consistent with the divine will, then everything else would follow, including Elkanah. Question is, of course, when did she speak with Elkanah about it? Well, I think clearly before the matter recorded in the next phrase. Because verse 19 goes on to say that when they got to their house, when they got home, Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife. Yahweh remembered her. Now, Hannah must have spoken with Elkanah before that moment, mustn't he? Mustn't she? Because there were huge implications. This child, should there be one, was pledged to God. Even the child's conception needed to occur within the sacredness of a couple that were united together in their understanding of what this child was about and their intention of what to do if the son was born. They absolutely had to be united. There was no possible way that Hannah could not talk to Elkanah first. She couldn't tell him her vow after conception, could she? Even their union was sanctified by a vow that must now be shared and a prayer offered together for Yahweh's blessing upon them both. You see, Elkanah couldn't just permit Hannah's vow to stand. Elkanah needed to join the vow. He needed to make her vow his vow. And Yahweh remembered his handmaid, says the record. He responded not only to her vow, but to the absolute conviction with which her vow had been made. You see, he'd never forgotten Hannah, but he was just waiting, simply waiting the moment of opportunity that was consistent with his purpose. And part of that, as we've already discovered, lay in the timing. God knew what the timetable was. He knew when Samuel needed to step up to be the leader. God already knew that. He was waiting for the moment of his own plan, not Hannah's. It was Hannah that had to learn about God's plan, not the other way around. So she'd have to talk to Elkanah, wouldn't she? Well, you see what verse 20 says? By the way, I think we've got good reason to discover later on in the passage that they most certainly had spoken together. It says in verse 20, it came to pass, when the time was come about that Hannah had conceived, she bare a son and called him Samuel, saying, because I've asked him of Yahweh. Now, you see what it says when the time was come about, but the margin says in the revolution of days. But actually, the actual Hebrew words used here are the same word used back in chapter 1, verse 3, when it talked about going up from year to worship. And it will be the same word used in verse 21 about the yearly sacrifice, and the same word used in chapter 2, verse 19. She brought it up from year to year when she came out with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. And I think that this phrase come about in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 20 actually relates to the cycle of the worship calendar that this particular family had. And that what we're being told is that the child was born exactly 1 year later. That Samuel was born on the anniversary of their previous visit to Shiloh. Now, you can imagine how wonderful that would have been. She goes up to Shiloh, she pours out her soul to Yahweh. She goes home at peace, she tells her husband, and that child is born exactly 12 months later at the time of the normal yearly ascension of this family to Shiloh, and now there's a little baby, there's a little child there. And I think that's what the answer of this particular cycle was. It's remarkable, actually, what the verse says. Not only that the child was born in that special way to connect to the anniversary of their yearly pilgrimage, But you notice that it says, and she bare a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I've asked him of Yahweh. Interesting, by the way. We've got to read the record carefully. Do you notice it doesn't say that Elkanah named the child? Did you see that? Hannah calls Samuel by his name. So why didn't Elkanah name the child? Well, he certainly could have. But you see, I think he loved Hannah sufficiently to know that this child was incredibly special. And I think Elkanah said, Hannah, the child has come. We both prayed for this. I've joined your vow. You name the boy. You choose. Choose, Hannah. Choose for both of us what the name of the child shall be. Now, there was a man, don't you think? A man who permitted his wife this joy. Because, see, the name wasn't ordained by God, so there was choice. And, of course, there's lots of examples in Scripture of when a woman does name a child. So it's not unusual that this be the case. But I think that Hannah has joined into the spirit of this occasion. And he says to Hannah, Hannah, you choose the name. So it's interesting because it says, doesn't it, verse 20, she called his name Samuel, saying, because I've asked him of God. And the margin says that Samuel's name means asked of God, which it doesn't. It doesn't mean that. Because Samuel's name did not commemorate that Hannah had offered prayer, that she'd asked God. Hannah's name commemorate that Yahweh had answered the prayer. And Samuel means heard of God, not asked of God, heard of God. And it commemorates the fact that that prayer uttered on that previous visit to the sanctuary has now been heard, has now been answered. And as a result of that, this little child has been brought into existence, the child of Hannah's dreams and aspirations, not for herself, but for the nation. And because Yahweh had heard her and remembered her, she called his name Samuel, saying, because I've asked him of God, I'll call him Samuel because he heard me. And that's why I believe he was called the name he was. And so the record says in verse 21, it says, and the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto Yahweh the yearly sacrifice and his vow. So he's careful, Elkanah's careful to let nothing hinder the fulfillment of his commitments in Shiloh. The normal yearly cycle will continue. And interestingly enough, do you see what it says, verse 21? The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto Yahweh the yearly sacrifice and his vow. Ooh, that's interesting, isn't it? His vow. Well, what was his vow? Well, we're not told. But the sudden introduction of this piece of information on the occasion of the very first visit to the sanctuary after the birth of Samuel, I think is an indication that that vow, the vow of Elkanah, is in some way connected with that child. And I think the inference is that his vow was a vow of special thanksgiving that the child had come, the safe arrival of the child. And what we're being told is that Elkanah had not just entered into a compact with Hannah to endorse her vow, he'd added his vow concerning this child to the same end. And so what we're being told now is that this couple are absolutely united concerning the destiny of their son. Now they've both made vow concerning this child that he will be given back to God. Elkanah's part of that. So there's a marvellous thing here, you see, because I think Hannah went home and she said, look, I'll tell my husband at the right time about this. Incidentally, just thinking about it, if the child was born on the anniversary of their yearly pilgrimage, how long was she home before the child was conceived? And the answer is about 3 months. True? One visit at the end of the yearly cycle, a 9-month gestation, born at the time of the next yearly sacrifice. She was home for 3 months. There was plenty of time to talk to Elkanah about this matter before this child was conceived. And as a result, good man that he was, righteous man that he was, Elkanah absolutely entered into the spirit of his wife and joined his vow with hers. And yet we're told in verse 22 that Hannah, despite the fact that the yearly pilgrimage had come, Hannah went not up. For she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him that he may appear before Yahweh and there abide forever. So you see, she shared Elkanah's earnestness in keeping their yearly cycle, and therefore to not go up on Hannah's part was clearly a departure from her normal routine. And in fact, some people have suggested that the reason why she didn't go up is that she wanted to delay going up in order to spend more time with the child, to have the child to herself, almost as if there was some selfish aspect to Hannah here. That she didn't go up, she said, no, I want to spend time with my boy. I don't think that's actually what Hannah means at all. I don't think that's the spirit of Hannah on this occasion. Read carefully what she does say. She's not being selfish here. What she said is, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him, that he may appear before Yahweh, and there abide forever. There's no doubt in her mind what's going to happen ultimately. But you see, I think the reason for that was this. You see, I think this is, in fact, a striking indication of her determination to fulfill her vow, not to try and put it aside. And I think the lesson's this. We shan't turn it up, but there's a passage in Leviticus chapter 22 and verse 27 that says this. I'll just read it to you. It says, when a bullock or a sheep or a goat is brought forth, it shall be 7 days under the dam, and from the 8th day and thenceforth, it shall be accepted for an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. No animal first born and dependent on its mother was to be taken from that mother till after 7 days before it could be used as an offering. And I think Hannah knew, verse 22, as only a mother can, that until this child was completely independent of her, he could never be Yahweh's. In the absolute sense. When she took him up, she needed to leave him there. And right now he's a sucking child who's utterly dependent on his mother. She said, I can't take him now. The moment I do take him, I've got to leave him behind. And so she would not bring him up until she could end his dependence on her so that she could walk away and leave him there. So this was not an endeavor to delay the vow or defer the vow. I think it was a sign that shows her absolute commitment to fulfill the vow. But she said, I've got to do it right. I'm only going to do it once. When I take this child up, that's it. And so in order to do that, I've got to wean him first. I've got to get beyond that period so that I can truly leave him in Shiloh. And why am I taking him up? That he may appear before Yahweh. You see, she was absolutely clear in her mind who this child belonged to. That children are an heritage of Yahweh. And she knew what her son's purpose in life would be. And of all those who appeared before Yahweh, the priests were preeminently chosen to come near to God. And that's the work of priesthood that Hannah's got in mind for her boy. I want to take him up to the tabernacle, to the sanctuary, that he might appear before Yahweh like the priests do. And how long will I leave him there for? That he might abide there forever, says Hannah. Which is equivalent to all the days of his life from her vow of verse 11. All the days of his life, verse 11. That he may abide there forever. Verse 22. I think Hannah's reasoning was spiritual and wise, and clearly Elkanah understood and agreed, because verse 23 says, Elkanah her husband said unto her, do what seemeth thee good, tarry until thou have weaned him, only Yahweh establish his word. Do what seemeth thee good, tarry until thou have weaned him, only Yahweh establish his word. Now, it's interesting. You see that little phrase, only Yahweh establish his word. See, there's actually no word of promise of God specifically mentioned in the passage for Hannah to establish or for even God to establish. But the Septuagint translates that phrase this way, and I think the Septuagint might be right in the matter when it says, may the Lord establish that which has gone forth out of thy mouth. Not his word, thy word. Hannah's word. I'll just say that again. The Septuagint says, may the Lord establish that which has gone forth out of thy mouth. In other words, may God fulfill thy vow. May Yahweh himself cause thy vow to be established. By the way, not Elkanah. Elkanah's not saying it's his job to establish the vow, but he's saying, may God establish your vow. That is, in giving the child back, may Yahweh enable you to fulfill your own vow. And I think there's a reason why the Septuagint translation is right. And I'll tell you why. You see that word establish? That's the same word that we found in Numbers chapter 30 and verse 14 about a husband establishing the vows of his wife. May those vows be established, the law said, confirmed that they might stand. So Hannah had made a vow. And now I think Elkanah is saying, may Yahweh establish that which has gone forth out of thy mouth. May he establish thy vow. And the second is that the Septuagint says that which has gone forth out of thy mouth, but that actually comes from Numbers chapter 30 and verse 2. Because in that law concerning vows, it said in Numbers 30 verse 2, if a man vow a vow or swear an oath, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. Numbers 30, verse 2. And now Elkanah says, may Yahweh establish that which has gone forth out of thy mouth. I think that's exactly what the phrase means. So he's asking God to establish and to assist Hannah in that fulfillment of the vow. I think Elkanah saw the entire matter as being divinely orchestrated by God, working in their lives. And so he exhorted Hannah to complete her part, that God in turn might fully accomplish his. And so verse 23 says, at the end of the verse, so the woman abode and gave her son suck until she weaned him. And for Hannah, weaning her son was the process by which he became independent of her, not just physically, but mentally and spiritually. So from the outset, this babe was going to be nurtured towards this end, that he was going to have to be taken up and left at the sanctuary. Right from the first moment, Hannah was on a mission to do this with this particular child. You know, I think verse 23 perhaps answers another question. It answers an interesting question. And the question is this: how long do you think Hannah's vow for her own Nazariteship lasted? Well, we know she'd already vowed not to drink wine or strong drink before she'd even conceived a child, so that he could be a Nazarite from the womb. But I think that perhaps her vow, and this is what she's really saying to Elkanah, is, and until I have weaned the child, so that even that which I feed him of mother's milk, I have not drunk wine or strong drink at any time during that whole process until I hand this child over. And I wonder whether Hannah's own Nazarite vow goes right through to the time when she would take the child up and hand him over at the sanctuary in Shiloh, that only then would her own Nazarite vow cease. From before his conception, right through to the end of his weaning and his presentation. Now here's the thing, you see, as a married woman, she wasn't free to make a lifelong vow. She couldn't make a Nazarite vow forever with responsibilities to her husband and family. It limited a woman's ability as to the extent of a Nazarite vow. But for this period, she might make that vow, so that everything about this child, from the start to the finished, including his early nourishment, was related to the spirit of separation and holiness. And that vow, no doubt, Elkanah heard about and Elkanah consented to. She's going to nourish that little boy right from the start, that he might have an inkling of the destiny that lay before him. How long do you think she gave him suck for? Verse 23. Or in other words, verse 24, when she'd weaned him, she took him up with her. How long do you think that was? Well, I know there's various views on this, but I think the best scriptural argument is 3 years. That she fed him for 3 years. Now, there's two particular pieces of evidence for that. One of them is extra biblical, but it's, I think, valid nevertheless. In the second of Maccabees, chapter 7 and verse 27, we've got this quotation. By the way, Book of Maccabees. Now, you'll realise the Book of Maccabees is not part of inspired scripture, but what is it? It's an authoritative historical writing of the epoch between the Old and the New Testaments about the history of the Jewish people. So it's a piece of historical work. So it's thoroughly acceptable from that point of view as historical evidence of what went on in those days. We're not quoting it in the sense of inspiration. But just like we'd quote any historian of the time, we would quote history as being an accurate reflection of those circumstances. So 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verse 27, quotes a mother in terrible distress in the time of the Maccabees because of terrible persecution against the family. And she says this, "Oh, my son, have pity upon me that bare thee 9 months in my womb and gave thee suck 3 years." Says Maccabees, 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verse 27. "I bare thee 9 months in my womb and gave thee suck 3 years." And I think that 3 years is correct. And I'll tell you why. Because if you come back to the book of Chronicles, the first of Chronicles chapter 31, let me show you another connection of reasoning with regard to the time for the weaning of children. Let me just check again. It's actually the second of Chronicles chapter 31. And verse 16. And that passage says this. Now, this is the numbering of the Levites for the maintenance of the sanctuary. This is the preparation of the resources of the sanctuary that it might take care of the Levites, given that they had no lands or inheritance of their own. So the record says, 2 Chronicles 31, verse 16, "Beside their genealogy of males, from 3 years old and upward unto everyone that entereth into the house of Yahweh, his daily portion for their service in their charges according to their courses." So when the Levites were registered for the maintenance of the sanctuary for their food and their provisions, when did they calculate the number from? From 3 years old and upwards. Now, why did they take the calculation from that moment in the child's life? And the reason is that prior to that age, that child was totally dependent on their mother for provision because they weren't weaned. But from 3 years old, the sanctuary must be in a position to take care of them because they are now weaned children. And so I think that when the record says, back in Samuel, that when she'd weaned the child, that she took him up, that we're probably dealing with a child that's 3 years old. A very little child, by the way. And I think the record's going to support that conclusion. So here's what it says, 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 24. So let me just draw attention to a couple of other interesting things about this passage. So it says, when she'd weaned him, she took him up with her. Do you notice that? She took him up with her. This is Hannah's vow. This is Hannah's offering. It's not Elkanah that takes the child up. Oh, Elkanah might be there. In fact, we know that Elkanah is there, but there's no mention of Elkanah in this context. No, it's Hannah that takes the child up. Because this is now the completion of Hannah's vow. And so what does she take up with her? When she'd weaned him, she took him up with her. And with them, she took 3 bullocks and 1 ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought him unto the house of Yahweh in Shiloh, and the child was young. Now, some of you will probably know that there are 2 different translations for that phrase, 3 bullocks in verse 24. And some translations say, a bullock of 3 years. And I think that's correct. And I'll tell you why in a minute. I think it was a bullock of 3 years. There is a problem with the amount of flour, because the amount of flour here is considerably more than was actually needed for a meal offering for a bullock. It was about 3 times too much flour, which is why people think there were 3 bullocks. But actually, whichever way you look at it, you've got a problem, because it says in the next verse that they were going to slay 1 bullock, but if there were 3 bullocks, then there's no reference to the remaining 2. Or there's only 1 bullock, in which case you appear to have too much flour. So you've sort of got a problem either way. But I think the correct answer is that she took up one bullock of 3 years old, which is how a number of translations translate it, and more than enough flour and a bottle of wine, and brought them with her to the sanctuary. She brought a bullock, which was the largest animal possible in the process of dedication. A burnt offering of dedication, the largest animal you could bring was a bullock. Here's this little child, she brings a bullock. Well, she wasn't just dedicating any child. This was a child of promise. This was a child of destiny. This was a child of purpose. So she brings the largest offering she can for the dedication of this child. And the record says, at the end of verse 24, and the child was young. Do you know that in the Hebrew it actually reads, the little child was a little child. Same Hebrew word. But it's almost as if the record exclaims, you see, the little child was just a little child. Which makes sense, by the way. If the child's only three, that's a little child, isn't it? Even today we would say three is still very little. So you see what they did. Verse 25. They slew a bullock. Now that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says they slew the bullock. And that's why we believe that the one bullock of 3 years old is the correct translation in verse 24. And let me tell you why. Because who did the bullock represent? The bullock represents the child. What's going to happen to the bullock? They slay the bullock. What's going to happen to the child? They brought the child to Eli. See how those two phrases are set off one over against each other in verse 25? They slew the bullock, which is now about to be sacrificed as a whole burnt offering dedicated to God. And what did that bullock represent? And they gave the child to Eli. So you see, the slaying of a bullock, one bullock of 3 years old, was the perfect match for a child of 3 years old who's now going to be dedicated forever to the sanctuary service. Just as that bullock is going to be wholly consumed, this boy was going to be dedicated as a whole burnt offering in Yahweh's service. Hannah understood all of this. She brought all the right sacrifices to betoken what actually was going to happen to her son on that day. Oh yes, he was going to abide there forever. That bullock demonstrated that. And that's partly why I believe that the child truly was only 3 years old, because this one bullock of 3 years was chosen to represent the child at the moment of his dedication. And she said, verse 26, having brought the child to Eli, she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto Yahweh. You see, it's emphatic in the Hebrew, that stood by thee here, right here, on this spot. She brought him to the very spot where Eli's seat was, before whom she'd prayed previously. How could Eli forget? He remembered this woman from 3 years ago, don't you think? This woman whose strangely, intensely personal prayer had deceived him into thinking she might be drunken, and whose answer was so scriptural and so passionate that he himself was embarrassed and actually said, go in peace and may the God of Israel grant thy petition. And now she comes back and she says, I'm the woman that prayed, you remember? How could he ever forget? She comes right back to that same place. She says, here's this child. In fact, you see what she says, verse 27. She says, for this child I prayed, and Yahweh hath given me the petition which I asked of him. Do you know where she gets those words from? Yahweh's given me the petition. She quotes Eli's words back to him. Verse 17. And Eli said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she comes right up to the spot 3 years later and she says, I'm the woman that prayed, and for this child I prayed, and Yahweh, quoting him back to him, Yahweh hath given me my petition which I asked of him. And so she quotes Eli's words joyfully back to him. In effect, she says, this is what you said, and this little boy is what our God has done. You see, she rose above herself, didn't she, in all of this? It was always about the accomplishment of God's purpose, not her own. Can you imagine how astonished Eli was, not only that she'd come back and not only that this little child was there, this little child of 3 years, but next minute she's pushing him forward And Eli suddenly realizes that she's handing the child over. And she says, verse 28, "Therefore also I've lent him to Yahweh. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Yahweh." You see that word lent? That's the same word as the word petition and the word asked in verse 27. So if you're going to literally render what Hannah says in verse 28, it's almost as if she's saying, "Yahweh hath given me my asking, which I asked of him, and I also have given back what was asked to Yahweh. As long as he liveth, he is asked for Yahweh." So now we've got the completion of Hannah's vow. She had never asked for herself. She had always asked that she might devote the child to Yahweh's service. And so I think that the tense of the word used here indicates that that's the very point of Hannah's intention. So Young's literal translation says, for verse 28, "I've caused him to be asked for the Lord." Or ASB, "I've granted him to the Lord." NASB, "I've dedicated him to the Lord." Rodham says, "I've loaned him to the Lord." And yes, he was on loan, but it was a loan for life in the spirit of joyful surrender. And the margin, I think, captures the spirit and the sense of the passage when it says, "I have returned him whom I have obtained by petition to Yahweh." As long as he liveth, was Hannah's conscious and deliberate recollection of her own vow in verse 11, all the days of his life, as long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Yahweh. "If thou wilt give unto thy handmaid a man child, I'll give him unto Yahweh all the days of his life." So when she stands before Eli, and she takes this little boy, on whom all her love has been poured for these last 3 years, and he's weaned, and she's going to say goodbye. Wouldn't matter what you thought about the purpose of God. Can you imagine that moment? Say goodbye. And one of the gripping questions of this story is, how could Hannah bring her 3-year-old son, who the record itself says is but a little child, and leave him in Shiloh, which was the very center of wickedness in the land? How could she leave such a little child with Eli, whose own lack of fatherly discipline, whose own lack of faithfulness had resulted in the very corruption of priesthood that Hannah sought through this child to reverse? How could she do that? It was all real to make all this vow, but when the point came in Shiloh on that day, why didn't all her maternal instincts, all her protective care, warn her that the risks and dangers in this place were too great? Why bring him at all? But you see, this child had not been brought to Shiloh to be with his mother. He'd been brought to Shiloh to be with his father. And the answer to the puzzle, you see, sisters, is that Hannah wasn't loaning Samuel to Eli. She was loaning him to God. And her very act in leaving him there was not an evidence that she was irresponsible or negligent or foolhardy. No doubt others thought so. It was driven by her absolute belief that the logic of his gracious birth made necessary the logic of his joyful return. If she'd asked for a child so she could give him back to God, and God had given her the child, then the sheer logic of it must be that she ought to give him back to God. And the logic of his joyful return made possible the logic of his providential care. She gave to God the first fruits of her womb, knowing that she gave what was already God's own, received by her as a blessing of trust, but only to this time. And nothing other than that passionate belief that Hannah had, that this was all in accordance with the purpose of God, nothing other than the fact that she believed that implicitly makes sense of this dramatic moment. Why else would you do it? Why else would any mother do this? But you see, her conviction that Samuel belonged to God gave her the emotional strength to surrender him completely. And so she brought Samuel from their house, verse 19, to the house of Yahweh, verse 25, verse 24. And there in the father's house, this little child would grow in wisdom and favor with God. And he would grow up safely in that place, because he was indeed going to be loaned to God himself. And the proof that it all worked out, the proof that it all worked out exactly as Hannah had hoped and Hannah had prayed, lies in the last little sentence at the end of the verse. See how it closes? It says in verse 28, therefore also I've lent him to the Lord, lent him to Yahweh. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Yahweh. And he worshipped Yahweh there. Question is, who's the he? Who's the he at the end? He worshipped Yahweh there. Well, some people, some commentators have said, well, it can't be Samuel because he's too little. So it must refer to either Eli on receiving the child, that he worshipped God, or Elkanah on joining Hannah in the giving of the child, that he worshipped God. Well, I suppose both of those are possible. Eli might have worshipped and Elkanah might have worshipped. But I think the context favours. Well, who do you think the context favours? Well, every time the word he is used in this verse, who does it refer to? Therefore also I've lent him, Samuel, to Yahweh, as long as he, Samuel, liveth, he, Samuel, shall be lent to Yahweh, and he, Samuel, worship the Lord there. That's what the context would suggest, would it not? That the logical reading of that last sentence is that it's Samuel himself that will worship God in this place. Now, he obviously didn't worship God in full at this very moment. He's only a little child. But I think what the record is telling us is that this little boy now began to develop that special relationship with God from this day forth that would mark him out as a faithful priest. This passage is going to begin a series of descriptions concerning this little child and the God that he comes before. For this child I prayed, verse 27, and he, the child, worshipped Yahweh there, verse 28. Not immediately, but it began at this moment of time. You see, verse chapter 2, verse 11, and Elkanah went to Ramah, and the child did minister before Yahweh. Again, verse 18, Samuel ministered before Yahweh being a child. It's the child's relationship with Yahweh that's going to be played out through this story, and that begins right here in verse 28. In fact, even the word there, you see the last word in the chapter? And he worshipped Yahweh there is, I think, an echo of Hannah's earlier promise. Verse 22, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him that he may appear before Yahweh and there abide forever. And so there now Samuel was. And in this place Samuel will grow into Yahweh's servant exactly as God intended, exactly as Hannah desired. It was on her part an act of extraordinary faith, because despite all the logic, the emotional experience on that day in Hannah's life must have been enormous, don't you think? Just absolutely enormous. You could easily imagine her filled with sadness, holding back the tears, committed but sorrowful at the final real cost to this vow. And yet the strange thing is that her spirit was the very opposite. She would give the little Levite with a joy so fierce that it was breathtaking in its intensity. How could she possibly be joyful on this day? Well, that's the subject of our next study. So shall we close with a hymn whose words now we might see a new dimension to in the story of Hannah and the bringing of this boy. Hymn 175. And as you sing, think of Hannah. We give thee but thine own, whate'er the gift may be. All that we have is thine alone, a trust, O Lord, from thee. May we thy bounties thus as stewards true receive, and gladly, as thou blessest us, to thee our first fruits give. Hymn 175. You have 15 minutes to stretch your legs.